Hey, what's up, everybody? We're back with another edition of the Ad Podcast. And today I'm super excited about the show. Jacob Tell has been a friend of mine going back since pretty much since I've been in the industry. So over 13 years, we've had a relationship. He's been a past client with his ad agency, Oniricom. And he's got some exciting new ventures, one called Lodo Studios, which is an event space in Santa Barbara. And then District 216, which is a social club membership in and around the burgeoning legal psychedelics community. So I'm super excited to talk to him about all the stuff he's doing right now. He's a huge resource. And really the theme of this show is how to live your passion, be 100% all in on your authentic self. And really, like, how do you take your dreams, your visions, and turn that into a business? So I'm super excited to talk to Jacob today. Thanks for coming on the show, buddy.
Thanks for having me, Dylan. It's great to see you. Even if we aren't in the same room, I always like when you come to Santa Barbara, we get some tacos. But I'll take this as a good runner-up.
I love it. Well, we'll make tacos happen soon. So, Jacob, you know, what I think it's super interesting about you is, you know, you've been an entrepreneur since day one. You know, we've not all had that opportunity, but you pretty much started your agency pretty shortly after school, after you came off touring with Jack Johnson. So can you tell me a little bit about any of the background stuff that I might have missed, maybe fill in any gaps, and maybe just walk us through a little bit of the highlights.
I mean, honestly, it was flipped. I started Oniricom before I graduated UC Santa Barbara, because we had a little bit of an opportunity. We didn't really know what we were doing. We were like three dudes with the internet kind of becoming a thing, that we, two of the three were engineers, so they knew what they were doing. I was more on the design creative side. So we were able to like put together web experiences, you know, websites and early apps, and early e-commerce. And we were lucky enough to do it for musicians and filmmakers and entertainment brands. I didn't even know what the word agency or marketing agency was when we started. I probably would have described ourselves as like a web shop, design and development focused. And yeah, that was enough to get us into the music industry, which led to clients like Jack Johnson and led to opportunities like running the merchandise on the road, not just online.
Yeah, no, I love that. So we were both majors at UCSB in the film department. I graduated in 2004. I don't think we had much overlap in school, but what?
A little bit. I graduated in 02. So not okay, too. Okay.
Yeah. So I was probably like, you know, at the frat house doing stands and hadn't quite got into my, my major classes yet. But, what did you want to do? Like you went into the film major at Santa Barbara. Like, what was your intention going into that major and what was your plan? You know, I don't know if it was for me, I never planned to get into the advertising industry. So that wasn't on my checklist.
I don't know that. I mean, I definitely didn't plan what happened. I'll tell you that. Whether or not I planned to be entrepreneurial, I don't know. I thought for the film side of things, I was certainly going to become a screenwriter. I mean, that was kind of my passion, was writing. You know, as you know, UC Santa Barbara's film, and now it's called the Film and Media Studies program, they added and media that we didn't have. That was a theoretical driven program, right? We didn't do a lot of hands-on production. There was some opportunity for some production, but it's not like USC or UCLA or some of these other programs where they're just hardcore getting in people ready to go into the industry and work hands-on as, you know, best boys or dolly grips or whatever. So for me, it was like the reading, the writing, the synthesis of the films, and then coming up with my own concepts in trying to write scripts. I realized after having some classes with Professor Portuguese and some others that I was not a very good screenwriter at all. I mean, it was very challenging to write, to come up with an idea even, let alone write a script that was worth writing. I loved how much he would just poke holes in everybody's ideas.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I actually had the same intention. So,
okay.
I knew I wanted to be in the entertainment industry to some degree, and definitely went into the film program with that intention, but not really knowing, like, you know, what part of it. And then same thing, I took a City College screenwriting course, and I had a lot of fun and really enjoyed it and got some good direction. And then I took Paul's classes as well. And what I loved about Paul's classes was it was like the closest thing to replicating a TV writer's room.
Yes.
I love the creative process of like fleshing out a story with a group of people versus like hiding in a cave, hitting keys by myself.
Totally.
I love that collaborative creative process. So I thought I was going to be a screenwriter too. And I went to LA after school and had a bunch of jobs in the entertainment industry. And I got to sit down with Stephen J. Cannell before he passed away. Oh, wow. And talk to him. He was the second most prolific producer of the 80s and 90s with like Commish, 21 Jump Street. Probably mm-hmm. only Aaron Spelling did more TV than he did.
Yeah.
And he asked me, he's like, "Hey, Dylan, you know, what's your process as a writer?" And I was like, "Oh, that's an interesting question." Well, at the time I was a development executive at Nash Entertainment, and I told him, "Well, I basically do, you know, my day job, which is show up at 9 and leave at 6:30, and I do all the things that I have to do for my boss. And then if there's not a networking event at night, I spend 1 hour at night to write on scripts." And he like laughed at me, and I was like, "What's so funny?" And he said, "Well, Dylan, when I graduated college, I took a job at my dad's furniture store, and I worked in the furniture store from 9 to 5. When I got home, I wrote from 5 to 10 PM every single night. My wife put dinner on the table at 10 o'clock. And then I wrote a half day on Saturday. And it took me 4.5 years with that schedule in order to get my first pilot gig." And I was like, "All right, I'm not going to be a writer anymore."
I thought you were going to say like, you got home, you smoked a joint and then you let it flow. But yeah.
That's
amazing to see that contrast. Now I think you just get in a dark room with ChatGPT and, you know, make love to the bots.
Yeah. I think for me, it was just that realization that I liked the business part of the entertainment industry, but I didn't like the discipline of the writing piece. So
sure.
Yeah, bit of a tangent, but anyways, so
it's a good one. Creative process is, I think, going to be a common thread throughout our chat. So that's a great, great foundational piece.
I love it. All right. So my next question for you is, obviously, you took your agency and you went a inch wide and a mile deep with the music industry to start. Mm-hmm. So what was your passion point between kind of blending the world of digital technology, marketing, and then the music space? And why did you decide to go so deep in that vertical?
Yeah, I feel like we've now, with 23 years of hindsight and running this creative agency for this whole couple of decades and going through so many ebbs and flows and pivots and all the things that you hear from entrepreneurs, that we had like maybe three of these transitional moments. First was music industry. The next, fast forward, mid-2014-15 was cannabis. And then now with psychedelics. But the music industry, like, what that was at the time was the first domino to go analog to digital. Music industry was pre-newspapers, video games, television, film. Audio files were much easier to stream than video files. First of all, it was a bandwidth, it was a technology thing. All of these, I mean, we take so much for granted. In 2001, there was no smartphones, there was no tablets. We barely had Wi-Fi. Now, Wi-Fi wasn't even ubiquitous in a lot of places. You still had, you know, we had our laptops with our Ethernet cables strewn out amongst, you know, through the apartments and stuff. And like, just the technological ability to take an industry digital was a huge first domino. And so we were there. Obviously, you had the Nutella clients, you had LimeWire and Napster and all those things. Eventually, Steve Jobs changed the world when he, you know, came out with his big presentation around iPod and eventually iTunes. And now we had this whole ecosystem and new way of selling MP3s and digital files. And we rode this decade long, you know, amazing transition until which time, you know, Spotify and the streaming services rained on that parade and everything, business models changed and marketing budgets shrank. And that's when we pivoted our way out into working with lifestyle brands and diversified away from music. But yeah, during that first era, it was like incredible because what you had were technologists like us that were trying to make the technology as invisible as possible to the end user and create like a really authentic emotional connection between artist and fan. And so you had all these toolkits coming out, marketing toolkits. You had amazing companies like Ian Rogers Topspin, and you had Band Page and Bands in Town and Songkick and all these things coming out to support this ever-growing, like, both DIY market as well as major label and big artist market, where people had to now consider new channels and ways of connecting with an audience that previously just wasn't part of their day-to-day.
Yeah, no, that's crazy. And you know what's wild is, you know, I know at least two other agency founders that started in music, and eventually they sold their agencies once they started doing brand work to the big boys. So M80 comes to mind, which is Jeff Simmons.
I remember them.
Yeah, so Jeff told me a funny story. We were at South By talking about like the early days of music marketing. And basically his point of view was like, once they stopped selling CDs, the bands couldn't pay even a $5,000 retainer anymore to run their social. Yeah. So they were like, oh man, that's where our revenue is coming from.
Yeah. There was a little bit of a gap, I would say, where some were making enough on MP3s off digital downloads, where you could say CDs/digital downloads, but totally agreed. Like, as soon as that revenue dried up and it went to this new model of getting a fraction of a cent per stream on streaming services, everything, like, the bands were like, marketing, we, like, all right, I guess our bass player is going to have to do everything now. Like, they couldn't necessarily do it anymore unless they had the big machine behind them. Even the big machine, we were working with Universal, Warner, Sonar, EMI, Disney, all those guys. And like, a lot of those budgets shrunk and dried up too, within the context of a major label relationship.
Yeah, totally. And he told me, like, so they had to pivot for the first time to pitch brands, you know, how boring. And he did his first proposal for Gap, and the the client called him back and they're like, hey, there's a problem with your proposal. And he's like, what's the problem? She's like, it's too small. If you send us a $5,000 proposal, nobody's going to take it seriously. And he's like, well, what should I do? He's like, add a zero to the end.
That's the best phone call you could ever get as an agency. Wow. Good for him.
Yeah. And, I know the marketing arm had their roots in, It used to be called like Fanology or something else before. I can't remember the name, but the guys over there, you know, eventually merged with the marketing arm and became part of Omnicom. But I love that you always stayed true, stayed independent, you know, stayed in it as long as you could, as long as the opportunities were there. But so let's
talk. It's funny, we just got a call a month ago from a Universal Music Group subsidiary. It's like, let's get the band back together. It's been 10 years. You remember us? Well, I was actually, do you remember us? And I'm like, yeah, totally. Do you remember us? Cool. So we're dipping our toe back in, and we still work with Jack Johnson in the Santa Barbara Bowl, and we cherry pick here and there. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, those relationships would always be able to re-blossom. But a lot of those people have scattered it all over other industries too.
Yeah, totally. So, so I want to talk about kind of your first pivot, and, you know, you were, I would say, ahead of the curve again when the cannabis industry, you know, started to pop up, especially with California being the first state to legalize. You know, a lot of activity in and around the Santa Barbara area on the venture side and the farming side, kind of Central Coast. So, what made you decide to, kind of take that first pivot and be an early adopter on the cannabis space?
Oh, great question. I mean, first and foremost, passion, right? Like, it's been in my DNA. When I was at UC Santa Barbara, was on the board of our local chapter for NORML, which is the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. I've always been very socially and politically active in the ways that I feel authentically aligned to, called to environmentalism, working with Jack Johnson and Earth Day. And even before that, with the cannabis issues and hemp and, you know, in the 90s, trying to provide patients with safe access to their medicines and all those things. So cannabis, you know, we rebranded to cannabis. It was always marijuana, but we've grown up. It's cannabis now.
Right.
So, you know, when cannabis became, you know, Oregon and Colorado first, and California was just around the bend, it made sense for us to start connecting in more with people in the area. Santa Barbara ended up issuing more licenses for cultivation than any county in the state of California.
Wow.
We still have more cultivators in Santa Barbara County between Carpinteria and up in the San Ynez Valley. There's just an inordinate amount of cultivators. And then you have distributors and some retail. But so for that reason, we started by hosting symposiums. Okay. So really building community and creating events around business development and networking and some thought leadership and sharing about future vision. That was part of the DNA as well. So like these things are sort of the precursor to what ended up becoming District 216 this last year. But we had been doing these community-driven events in cannabis and trying to position ourselves as, hey, we should be the go-to marketing branding agency of choice for y'all, whether you're, you know, getting a license or applying for a license, or you're an attorney trying to get in this space, or you've got land that you want to convert over to cultivation, or whatever those early conversations were. We were trying to bring as many of those folks in the room and create some sort of a community around it.
Yeah, that's super cool. And, you know, for me, I've been sober going on 10 years, but I'm a huge supporter of legalization. My dad has one of the licenses for Goleta, for basically all the licenses except storefront. So he's been in the industry for a long time.
Awesome. And,
you know, it's like, I just, from even as someone who no longer partakes, I see it as a miracle plant, you know, whether it's pain management, whether it's anxiety, whether it's, you know, sleeplessness. I mean, you know, Big Pharma has done a really good job in trying to demonize it, but it's just such a great, amazing plant for so many things on the health side. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, you know, what's the last time you saw somebody do anything really stupid when they're high? I mean, when people are drunk, they do all sorts of horrible and mm-hmm. brutal things. And, you know, it can cause a lot of problems within families and stuff like that. But I don't know. I've just never met somebody who's a recreational marijuana user that suffers from anything other than a case of the munchies or maybe a little bit of low motivation from time to time. But other than that, it's it seems like all the trends are pointing in the direction of, you know, cannabis is going in this direction, and, you know, traditional, I hope pharmaceuticals are going in this direction too. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I definitely know that spirits and beer are kind of on that, mm-hmm. you know, not a growth decline where cannabis.
Yeah. I mean, I well said to all your points, and thank you for highlighting all the, you know, the whys and the purpose behind, you know, why we're aligned with the space that we are. And I mean, going a step further with the pharmaceutical conversation, I would say that you're starting to see them push back on psychedelics a bit. I mean, what they're doing to try to demonize ketamine. I mean, that whole headline that came out about Matthew Perry with, you know, drowning on ketamine, which had nothing to do with ketamine itself. It was all other cocktail of things that were in his body, and, you know, being in a hot tub, not sober, is probably not a good idea. But, you know, watching Governor Newsom veto the psychedelics bill, I mean, if you follow the money, you will find that the Big Pharma is behind a lot of these moves at this time. And, you know, until they're able to patent a plant, you know, cannabis or whatever other psychedelic compounds, you know, that are coming out, analog derivatives of psilocybin mushrooms, that's when they're going to get involved, is when they can own and the patents and rights to these drugs. That's their game. So until that time, they're going to be pushing back on these things. But I think a lot of us have woken up to these alternatives. And what I keep saying is that we have an opportunity and the obligation to take healing into our own hands and actually look at healing as something that we're responsible for in our own lives within the context of a community, within the context of people helping us, whether that's, you know, on the psychedelic side, if you want to jump a little further into that, you know, finding guides or finding practitioners that you trust, or therapists, you know, ketamine assisted therapy doctor, for example. That is somebody taking healing into their own hands and saying, you know, we're not just having to go down this one pharmacological path that we were presented as kids, along with the whole white picket fence and the 2.5 kids and the American dream. I mean, we have these new ways of self-healing. So yeah, I think that people are starting to wake up to that more and normalizing the conversation through community, through events, and seeing productization and product development in new categories. Is all of those are cumulative efforts to seeing a cultural shift.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think also, you know, why I was really bullish about cannabis, you know, we were able to work with Dan Balzerian's company, Ignite, kind of in the early days, which was kind of the, you know, kind of the cool party brand, I guess, if for a lack of a better terminology, all the way to the other side of the spectrum, which is nativus, which is, you know, CBD beverage for housewives, essentially, as a supplement, right? So what I love is there's like a full spectrum, whether it's, you know, kind of more of the recreational party vibe, all the way to straight on just like, you know, CBD and marijuana derivatives and things from the cannabis plant for supplementation and sleep and anxiety. And, you know, as an influencer marketing agency, we've always been, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities of things to do when you're trying to market cannabis, because, you know, it's either outdoor advertising, do billboards, and I don't know how they got grandfathered into being allowed to do that. But as you know, like all the platforms, even if it's not illegal, they self-censor to a really high degree. Like Google starting to like open up the kimono. You've got, you know, ad networks like Canvu, and Facebook is starting to, you know, barely crack the door open, but really only for the big boys and for very specific use cases. So we were on the lucky end of being beneficiaries that content marketing was one of the tactics that you could pull off. And, you know, it was still a game of whack-a-mole, though, like
totally
getting struck in by the platforms and stuff like that of what was allowed, what was against community guidelines. You know, how do you make it not super call to action heavy and more lifestyle-y?
But I mean, funny enough, they're all for taking, you know, Russian fake news ad dollars all day long. That's cool. But, you know, a little CBD, I don't know. It's funny, like on Amazon, there was a whole, I don't know now, but this is maybe a few years back. It was like, just call it hemp derived and you're fine. Take the CBD off the label, put hemp derived in its place, and Amazon's cool. As soon as it says CBD, out. So yeah, just these arbitrary rule sets and watching the advertising community scramble to try to keep up with it, it just goes to show you how far behind a lot of the, you know, capitalistic interests are to the cultural shift that's occurring.
Yeah, no, totally. All right. Well, I want to spend a little bit of time on Lodo Studios, because I think that's pretty exciting and interesting too. So it seems to me, you know, I was living in Santa Barbara during COVID, you know, you and I were having conversations about how rough it was getting right as COVID was putting us all into lockdown. And, you know, it was a dicey time for all of us. You know, you guys had to send a lot of employees home to work from home, as everybody did. But you made a pivot and really turned your office space into a cash center for you. And I'd like to hear just a little bit about, you know, take me back to that time.
Yeah.
What was things like, and where was that? Where did you get that innovative, you know, light bulb moment to pivot to, you know, studio production, live streaming, kind of all the stuff that you guys did to not only survive but thrive during COVID?
Man, it starts with oh shit. It starts with that oh shit moment. Like, no joke. I remember just going like, what are we going to do with this overhead? Like, we just have this empty shell of a building. We had just gotten in a 15-year long-term lease. We had put in $250,000 to the building to make it beautiful. We had all these humans in here, and then now all of a sudden the humans are, I mean, this was like into 2018 that we had done all this work and we'd gotten our stride in 19, and now here's 2020, boom. So we really we were forced to figure out how to monetize the building. So we did it in sort of not necessarily planned this way, but it ended up being a three-phase rollout. First, we started with some tenants in the building. We had enough nooks and crannies where people could be 6 foot of social distance. They could be far enough away from each other to be behind a closed door, and we had all the things. We had the temperature check at the door. We had the hand sanitizing of the hands. We had the little decals on the floor. This is 6 feet apart. I mean, we did all the things that we all had to do. And so once we had a couple of tenants to anchor in, that helped a little bit with the overhead. And then from there, it was, as you said, you know, photo and video we had already been doing as a marketing agency. So we opened up the space to the creative community of Santa Barbara and the Central Coast here in California to invite others to come in and use the space for those things. We already had gear. We already had backdrops and green screens and even team that could come help in some cases where they needed assistance as well. And funny enough, we found one of our little niche COVID, you know, that we're talking 14 months here. We did 36 live streams for nonprofits. All we did was they couldn't do their galas. They couldn't raise their $250K for their operating budgets for the next year because events were dead, right? But what we could do is bring the event inside of Lotus Studios, do a live stream. We have the turnkey person, producer, gear, cameras, multicam type thing where we could switch live. And then we were doing the paddle raise or the virtual donations through the platforms.
Wow.
And they were able to like maybe not quite raise as much gross, but they made more net because they had a lower overhead. They didn't have to buy dinners for everyone and do the rubber chicken round table thing and all that. So it ended up being really an interesting, you know, roll with the punches, and 36 nonprofits got to benefit by hosting their live streams here. So that was kind of phase one, phase two. And then phase three, once COVID restrictions lifted enough, it was all about events. And it was like, all right, let's really stress test the building and do some fun things. So first it was like private parties. And then we ended up getting this amazing group called Don't Tell Comedy. They've come here and done probably at least 10, if not more, live comedy shows right here in our parking lot with chairs. And we could fit like two, we found out because of them, we could fit 225 folding chairs out there. So it was a, you know, bigger than most small venues in town. And, you know, they just did a BYOB and a blanket thing outside, and they had some nice lights and a couple of heaters, and it was cool. Then we did a few music events, and yeah, then it became like, okay, we've got something here. Let's actually kind of formally launch this out to the Santa Barbara community and say, hey, we are now a rentable venue. We have production event and production rentals on the two sides. And yeah, we've officially spun out Lotus Studios Inc. from Oniricom last year. It's become a separate entity. It's got separate ownership. It's got its own revenue. We've taken the overhead, a lot of the overhead off of Oniricom, so less burden for the agency to have, you know, so much of that overhead covered each month, which is fantastic. And Lotto can be its own thing and its own brand, and people are starting to have an affinity to it. So it's pretty cool.
That's awesome, man. Well, props, you know, it's always great to hear stories about people who are able to take their COVID experience and turn it into something, you know, long lasting and make it through. So that's I love that story.
Yeah.
So yeah, let's hop into District 216 now. So I think this is kind of the crux of what I wanted to talk to you and really get through to the audience. So, you know, you and I have known each other for going on 13 years. I knew you were a big Fish guy. That's pretty much what I knew about you. And I know, you know, the thing,
the band, for those of you that don't know, not like, I like fishing just fine, but going to fish concerts is what Dylan means. For those of you who need the P-H-I-S-H clarification.
Exactly. So I knew you were part of that culture, and I know some of the things that are, you know, associated with that culture, and let's, you know, that was kind of pretty much all that I knew. And then I started getting emails from your newsletter. I would got to say, you know, probably about a year and a half ago, maybe things kind of kicked off.
Yep.
And you took your passion, which is again being ahead of the curve, the legal legalization and commercial medicinal use of natural occurring psychedelics inside of medicine, and in a lot of states are looking towards recreational. Mm-hmm. Again, being kind of ahead of the curve on that, but you didn't just decide to create another agency capability or brand your specialty as an agency and go hard after that market and starting working with early stage companies in that space, which you could have done. You've done it before. You've done it successful in two other verticals up to this point, but you decided to really launch this community and is already kind of iterative in what you had done in the cannabis space. So tell me a little bit about, you know, what was this light bulb moment? And then I think the other thing that's really exciting, if you could, you know, spend some time touching base on, is, you know, I imagine you probably had a little bit of hesitation around sharing your authentic self, that this is part of who you were.
Definitely. And
kind of what would that mean to your professional reputation amongst your more kind of straight-laced clients, I suppose, or your network of people that don't know what that community is all about? I know that was a bit of a mouthful, but can you kind of dive into some of that?
Yeah, let's see if I can keep up with all those threads. I think I got you, though. Thank you for framing it so well, Dylan. I appreciate it. To piggyback off the Lotto thing, just to cut to that part, I think that's an interesting piece, is I rent for myself. So when we do these District 216 events here, they're at Lotus Studios. So I'd already kind of set this framework up, right? I've got this marketing agency. We've got this event space that we can bring communities together. I have a background in Santa Barbara, putting on community events, doing some private cannabis events with tasting lounges and consumption on site, pushing the boundaries of risk, right? Taking some risk there, pulling together thought leaders, doing some of this educational type. And also in the entrepreneurial startup world, we've worked with Startup Weekend and we've done some events around there. So if you put all that stuff in a blender, really, along with my passions, which, you know, these four pillars of content of District 216, art, music, cannabis, and psychedelics, that really what came out of it was District 216. The aha moments, there was a few of them, actually. First one happened kind of the tail end of the pandemic. I had a really, one of my best friends, we've co-created together. A lot of his art is here in our space. We've done, you know, media projects together. And he's just like, God, you're so good at events. You're so good at community building. Why aren't you doing more of it? And his challenging of me, and like, we're in this sort of like COVID pandemic. What are we doing with our lives? And I'm having to start this Lodo thing. And like, oh, wow, I'm rethinking things. And humans are moving around. And one of my business partners ended up moving to Australia and mixing up a lot of the energetics here. So it was just the perfect kind of set and setting to go, what? Yeah, I do want to do something more around community and events and production and media and all these things. Fast forward, I was at a fish run out in Denver a few years ago by this point. It was probably like, God, 2021. And my buddy was telling me about this venue that was doing psilocybin type events with music till 3-4 in the morning. And they were ticketed. I'm like, how are they? This is before Colorado had passed any sort of psilocybin legalization initiatives. And so I'm like, how is this possible? And he's like, oh, they sell memberships. And that was the big light bulb that went off around like the business model. And I was like, I want to do that in Santa Barbara. I want to have a membership driven psychedelic social club, which is essentially what came to be. So then I'm like, okay, cool. I got this idea. I start building decks. I start putting a little website together. I got to do a test event. So early in 2022, I was introduced to somebody who became the first proper doctor to move into ketamine assisted therapy. And I thought, okay, this is a perfect guy. He's come from like the medical world. He's moved in. He's tired of treating to the symptom. He wants to get to the root cause. This is a huge trend within the scientific and medical communities of why people are moving more and more into psychedelics, into psychedelic assisted therapy, is to get beyond symptom treating, as Western medicine is so good at, and going into the root cause and actually trying to make some real change in human thought patterns and behavior. And so this guy and I just hit it off, and I'm like, if I'm going to have him come and speak and be my guinea pig District 216 lecture on ketamine 101, what is it? Who is it good for? I need to try it myself. And so I ended up, myself and my partner, Carrie, we ended up doing, I did 6 sessions. She did 9 sessions. And it was so profound for both of us in so many different ways. All at the same time, my dad had just gotten to the tail end of his battle with cancer and passed away.
Sorry, man.
It'll be 2 years in February. So it's coming up. But this was all like, 2022, early on. And to your point about living in alignment and being fully out of the closet within, you know, the psychedelics, my psychedelics use and my proponent of it, and that whole ecosystem, that was a big catalyst, was saying, you know what, I know that I need to show up wholly, fully, authentically in alignment, and this is what I need to do. And so I think losing him and just kind of carrying his spirit forward into, I ended up writing this manifesto, which you can see on the District 216 website, and it just flowed through me. My dad was a poet and a writer, and I think there was a lot of channeling of his energy through that. And so that was, you know, those were kind of the big catalysts and the big kind of ahas along the way. I ended up doing that soft launch in May of 2022 with that doctor on the ketamine. And then I ended up going to Vegas in November to a psychedelic conference. And I was like, I've arrived. These are my people. They're very supportive of this concept. They're saying what this needs right now is community and roots and connectivity. all of which, you know, was in my plan for District 216. So I said, all right, let's do this. So January of 23, and I know this is a long answer, and I'm almost there.
Oh, I love it. Let's go.
We're on the plane for you. January of 23, we ended up doing our first formal launch. We call it our marquee event. 250 people plus showed up. We did it on, we had a discussion panel on VR as an integration tool for psychedelic therapy. Two amazing women that run a psilocybin group that use virtual reality headsets in their integration process. And that was the green light to go forward. Fast forward to last weekend, we had our 1 year birthday party. It was our veterans, PTSD and psychedelics marquee event. And that was our 55th event in a year.
Wow, that is insane. So how's it going from a business model perspective? You know, I know you've got the events, you've got the reoccurring club membership for people in the Santa Barbara area, or, you know, LA, if they want to drive up. And then you've got kind of a VOD subscription Patreon style model as well for those like me that can't get up to Santa Barbara all the time. How's the business model going?
Yeah. So when we launched, we didn't have content filmed in the can yet, right? We were still developing, you know, we launched with the marquee event. I didn't even start my weekly Wednesday night gatherings until March. So from like January to March, we had done one event. So really from March till this next January, 54 more events. So we're talking about a weekly Wednesday, interviews, lectures, presentations, mostly. Then we surveyed our audience and they're like, we want more interactivity. So we started to do roundtable conversations. We do a series called Dosage Dialogues. We talk all about dosing and sort of the 101 of that. And then we started another roundtable called Conscious Connections, where we allow people from the very novice level all the way up to psychonaut level to come in and ask questions and share experiences. And then we also do documentary screenings. So once we kind of figured out all the different formats of these Wednesday night weekly evenings that we host, membership started to flourish more. And then we started to capture content. So by the time September rolled around, we launched the online platform. We ended up using Mighty Networks, which is a great community-based technology. So we didn't have to build, you know, a brand new app. We were able to leverage something off the shelf and customize it. And we now have about 30 pieces of content. Those are 60 to 90 minute long pieces of content that are in there, video on demand for members. We sell online memberships all the way up to business memberships. So we have four different tiers. And yeah, our revenue streams are pretty diversified. We have the recurring revenue with our memberships. We have guest tickets. If people just want to come try it once, they can come to a Wednesday night, or they can come to the marquee events and buy guest tickets. We have sponsorships that we sell for brands and organizations that want to have a table at the big marquee events. And then we have our business memberships for brands that want to have more association with us long-term and get highlighted on newsletter and social media. So it's been great. We are looking forward to expanding into more geographies in the coming years. I'm looking at Denver and some other places in California. And but I think Santa Barbara has been a fantastic test market. We have drawn probably about 25% of our marquee events have come from the Bay Area, LA, San Diego, Vegas. So we have a fairly decent draw into Santa Barbara as well. I mean, who doesn't want to come here and see some good content? And we always put some live music there as well. And we call it edutainment.
I love it. And I love that you're already thinking about what's the franchise component. And I know you guys were promoting the psychedelic section of MJ Biz as well out in Vegas. So it seems like there's some potential for pop-up kind of, you know, opportunities out there in and around not just the business side of things, but maybe some of those intersections with music and culture, whether it's Fish or Dead & Co or, you know, other genres that kind of, you know, tie in, or even like a South by Southwest activation or something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to be more on site. We did two conferences so far this last year. And then we did one offsite event in Ojai with a breathwork facilitator. So we are thinking in terms of more pop-ups. I've been suggested by a couple of people that we ought to take it on the road and do like a tour and do a District 216 coming to a city near you. We thought a little bit about that. So, you know, that takes more coordination with localized communities in different geographies, but I think that's doable as well as a potential model, and maybe even to test out those markets before we decide to plant roots.
Yeah, that's cool. So I want to pivot the conversation a little bit to our side of the business. So how important is an influencer community to what you're doing with District 216? I mean, I'm going to be fully transparent that this is a niche that I have spent zero time diving into, but I imagine, you know, there's a niche for everything under the sun. There are metal detecting influencers.
I bet you you're in this space and you don't even necessarily realize it, because psychedelics is one keyword of many. I mean, you could call this the consciousness movement. You could call this the wellness community. Mm-hmm. You could call, there's tons of health and wellness brands. There's psychedelic adjacent groups. I mean, people that are doing harm reduction and safety and efficacy. You have other groups that are more interested in the policy side and looking at, you know, more of the social, you know, disruption of the laws. So there are, and then the therapists, psychotherapy and psychiatry community that's very active in the space too. So it's not just like mushroom brands or ketamine clinics or pharmaceutical, you know, potential future pharmaceutical plays. There are, there's a very healthy ecosystem of brands already that I'm sure you guys touch.
Yeah. Well, I think of like Ben and Jerry's even, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Bronner's, Dr. Bronner's soap, they're putting in tremendous amount of resources to the psychedelics ecosystem. They've donated to MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. They have added to their HR that you can cover ketamine assisted therapy as part of your benefits if you so choose. So there's some groups that are not head on psychedelic brands that are very influential within this ecosystem.
Yeah, that's super cool. Well, this has been awesome, man. You know, I wanted to ask you one other question. So how much does the events serve as potential lead gen into the agency? Are you doing interesting work around branding, packaging, digital presence, marketing? Like how many clients are you working with on the agency side that have kind of come out of the events community?
Yes, is the answer. We have a few of them that have already transitioned and others that are in the pipeline and others that aren't quite ready that know they are already aligned with us because of our values that when they are ready, they want to come, you know, hire a Neurocom. So I am wearing those hats fairly interchangeably. Like when I was in Vegas at the Remind Psychedelic Business Forum, I had a postcard for cannabis for an Aircom saying, hey, you have a cannabis brand, you need some packaging or branding or communications, look us up. And when they came to my booth, my District 216 booth, and said, oh, I have a cannabis brand, by the time they left, they were walking away also with an Aircom card as well.
That's smart. Yeah, very cool. Well, I love how you built this amazing ecosystem to align, you know, your passions around these different industries and still staying true to the music culture piece as well. I just love the story of, you know, what your journey was like of kind of, you know, diving into these spaces, but more importantly, you know, going public with it, breaking any stigmas associated or attached to it. And, you know, I think that's truly an act of bravery to be able to really like go into something and live your authentic self and not be concerned with, you know, any of the blowback. And it sounds like, you know, from all signs, everything is going in the right direction. It hasn't been any.
Thank you. Yeah. I hope it inspires others to do that, to live in alignment and to live fully authentically. We're tired of the war on drugs. We're tired of, you know, status quo. I'm hoping that people get inspired to positively disrupt the status quo as part of this. At the end of the day, this community is about taking healing into our own hands and having the obligation to heal within community, but not having to listen to, you know, this is the only way to deal with something. Like there are these other tools, there are other therapies, and there's a whole community here to support you in that process.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. All right, well, we're getting down to the final stretch here. So what are you most excited about the future with all these amazing irons you have in the fire?
I'm excited to see laws change. I really am. I think that we are going to see psychedelic compounds become federally prescribable before cannabis. MDMA and psilocybin, you will be able to prescribe for PTSD and depression before cannabis is federally prescribable. If you would have told that to my 18-year-old self, I would have said, no way. These are very exciting times. We have, you know, clinical trials that are in phase three for both MDMA and psilocybin. You have also ibogaine and DMT coming down the pipeline. There's a lot of amazing conversations around these different compounds that are so healing. And I think that humanity is in for a huge pivot. And I think it's really the antidote to any a concern around AI and around, you know, the human potential suffering as a lazy response to AI. I think that what we have over AI is the use of the responsible use of psychedelics. Wow. And that is our edge. I think that is our edge over AI. So I think that's going to be an amazing thing to see flourish over the next 20 years. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. You know, like I said, I'm currently still in the phase of life where, you know, nothing mind altering, but it's definitely, you know, I have friends in the industry that microdosing mushrooms is a very normal part of their creative process in big corporate structures that would completely maybe shock you, maybe not.
Would not shock me at all. Not at all. It's happening a lot more than people are willing to admit.
Yep, totally.
And you know, it needs to be normalized. Why can we go out and have a beer or a glass of wine at the end of the day, or even during lunch break, but we're not able to use these compounds when they're actually adding to our productivity, creativity, and flow?
Yeah.
So I could make arguments all day long against alcohol, really, and for psychedelics. So, well, if any of you out there are doubters, please let's have a conversation.
I love that, and not to derail, you know, us coming to a logical conclusion here, real quick. But I did think it was pretty awesome when I was doing the research on this show that you actually don't allow alcohol at your events. Can you talk?
No alcohol. They're dry events. We do have cannabis beverages. We do have elixirs that have other things like kava or kratom or, you know, some kana extracts. There's all these other things that are pretty social and amazing that you don't need alcohol to have a good time at a party. Who would have thunk it? But you could go to a lot of other places and drink. Ours is not one of them.
Nice. Awesome, man. Well, props for keeping the culture intact and, you know, not falling prey to that, because as you know, alcohol definitely moves the needle from a financial perspective when
sponsorship, I know,
to an event. So that must have been not an easy choice, but maybe it was. But you know, financially, again, just living that in that authentic lane that you're trying to build with that, with the community that you're trying to make it for. Well, awesome, man. Well, Jacob, as always, it's awesome to catch up and to get to hop on with you. So thanks so much for coming on today. And then for everybody at home, if you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe wherever you're watching or listening to this podcast. And if you would be so kind to leave us a review, that helps the show reach more and more people. And most importantly, if you have a colleague or a friend or somebody who you think would benefit from my conversation with Jacob today, please share the episode. Jacob, anything else you want to plug and let people know where to find you and where to reach out?
Sure. I mean, check out district216.com, subscribe to the newsletter. We send out a weekly newsletter with events. And then if you want to stalk me, I'm easy. I'm @JacobTell.
All right, man. Awesome. Thanks for coming on the show, bud.
Thank you.
Cheers. Cheers.